You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 30th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Thursday. We're still in quarantine, circling the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On this today's program, Kurt Hackbarth will talk about Corona in Mexico, how U.S. foreign policymakers, potentially Mexican elites, definitely are attempting to use the crisis to pursue an agenda of toppling Mexico's left-wing president. And how exactly is AMLO's record on Corona anyway? Tenants, the landlords, are bracing for the largest rent strike in decades. That's right. Turn necessity into a strike. Amazon, Walmart, and FedEx workers are planning a walkout on Friday, tomorrow, May 1st. Gotta support them, folks. Everybody join the boycott. Don't order anything from Amazon. Amazon proving once again to be perhaps the most dangerous private dictatorship in the world is cracking down on internal communication after a surge in worker activism. Donald Trump, not happy. Been presented with very bad and not good polling numbers, suggesting that his re-election chances are slipping away. And GOP senators also starting to get very concerned about the midterms, even as Democratic frustration mounts as the Biden campaign remains radio silent on the sexual assault allegation leveled against him by Tara Reid. Trump's appointees manipulated CFPB payday lending research, next staffer claims. Bolsonaro says, so what, to Brazil's rising corona death toll. And corona has forced a delay in that U.S. extradition in the profoundly dangerous anti-journalistic case against Julian Assange, who is still being held in inhumane and dangerous conditions inside the U.K. Joe Biden says he would leave the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem if elected, even as a new Israeli coalition government starts to formalize apartheid policies. And Congress quietly boosts spending on lawmakers' exclusive concierge health clinic. That's great, as 70% of tested inmates in federal prisons have COVID-19. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Greetings, Matt. Greetings, Brendan. How are you guys?
I'm doing well, Michael. How about yourself?
Well, good so far because the internet is holding up. Brendan, how you doing?
I did a internet dance right before we started the stream today, and I have to say it's working so far.
Yes.
And we're excited,
and we're looking at it very strongly. Wait, no. It's working and we're excited is a Kushner.
Right? Yeah, that's not precisely one. It, but that's close. Yeah,
it's working.
It's working, and we're very excited.
And we're very excited. Yeah. That's what it is.
I did the dance to help with connectivity, of course.
Oh yeah, to help with connectivity.
To help with connectivity.
We've had Mark Zuckerberg around here, just helping. He's a helpful guy.
Yeah, he's an extremely helpful guy.
So a whole bunch of new webcams installed.
Here. Right. I think at some point we all need to look at some open source alternatives to Zoom, guys, if we're going to start living our whole lives on these platforms for the you know, at least another several months. Yeah. I should also say, I can't believe I missed it, but another over 3 million more people applied, are jobless as we head towards that catastrophic $40 million unemployment number. Just to reinforce, it just needs to be said constantly and with relentless repetition. This is obviously the medical crisis, the pandemic itself is not easily solvable. That's going to require scientific collaboration, research, international coordination, all the rest of it. But we could give people $2,000 a month, suspend rent, and not backdate it. Like, there's not going to be any rent for the next several months. If you're a mom and pop landlord, we can subsidize you. We can actually cover people's full rent. If you're a big land, you know, if you're a big real estate conglomerate, you're going to have to eat the loss on this one. Sorry. We should be breaking you up and you shouldn't be allowed to exist anyway. That would actually be relatively easy to figure out if we got into it on a policy level. And folks could stay home. And then, of course, we would need hazard pay and serious protections for essential workers and so on. But the challenge of how to keep people fed and housed and participating in not spreading a pandemic is solvable like that. And we see many different places. I mean, even in Vietnam, they coordinate home food delivery, for God's sakes. They do this. I mean, you know, we've seen the testing deployment in South Korea and China. We've seen the coordination, I mean, in South Korea and Taiwan. We've seen a similar coordination in terms of food delivery in China. It's very important anytime somebody tells you that some situation is just hard or impossible to solve. It isn't. It's actually conceptually incredibly easy. The policy mechanisms might be hard to figure out because, as Mark Blythe and others have pointed out, essentially the only thing we're designed to do is pump money into the banking system and other monopolistic interests. But if we got serious about getting the pipes right, we could get money to people and folks could stay home and eat and be safe. This is not that hard.
Yeah, it's a choice. I mean, you know, we talk about how it's not even a failure of imagination. It's a failure of people standing in the way. We could just have, you know, Postal Service bank accounts that, oh, guess what? Your Postal Service bank account has $2,000 more in it on the first.
Yep. And that's going to roll for a year. And also, you know, and again, we're coordinating home deliveries. Now, we don't want to just go back to normal. Obviously, there's a ton of policy innovations internationally, nationally, and locally that could generate out of this to make a much more equitable, interesting, ecologically sensitive world. And that's what we have to be thinking about and doing. But the immediate, you just stay home and don't worry about this, is a completely artificial and brutal crisis in the United States. Completely. And folks need to remember that. And remember where to point the blame at. Now, Donald Trump is not doing too well. There was a period of time at the beginning of this crisis where his poll numbers are actually unusually high. I think it's important for people to look at Trump's numbers generally in two ways. One, for the, you know, resistance people who, you know, of course, hate Trump and Trump's utterly loathsome and all the rest of it. We know all of this. He's not a uniquely unpopular president. It's important to remember that. And that's not just with his base, to the extent that there's sort of, you know, I wouldn't even call them swing voters. I would call them sort of, you know, I don't even know how you define it, but there are some people who you could define as being in some sort of middle, a grab bag of politics. They don't necessarily like Trump at all, but they don't hate him in the same way that maybe you or I would. Now, on the other hand, he isn't popular and never has been particularly popular. I mean, this is a guy whose numbers are usually in the 40s, and he's generating from a fervent base that he has an incredible ability to communicate with. And of course, maybe the most ineffectual, embarrassing opposition party in modern political history. So those are the dynamics. In the beginning of the crisis, his numbers went up because he's the president, because he's out in front of it rhetorically, and because, of course, the Democrats have no leadership or strategy ever. And at the same time, there is raw objective realities, and we're in an immense public health and economic crisis. This guy let it happen. And it doesn't matter how much bloviating he does. It's very easy for people to figure out, including people who might be sympathetic to him, his egotism, recklessness, and stupidity that accelerated where we're at. And that's showing up in the numbers. You know, a lot of people, I would say, obviously people in 2016 were delusionally complacent about him not winning. I see certain contingents of people who are, frankly, way too confident that he's going to lose re-election. If we have an election and the trends stay and we have an election, Donald Trump's going to lose. And the reporting is reflecting that. Donald Trump does not like that reporting. And first, let's actually start with this 2-minute segment that Brian Williams, who, as we'll get to in a minute, is in fact, I think he is a pretty publicly demonstrated liar, but he's not lying about this. This is Brian Williams reporting on Donald Trump's bad poll numbers. And, you know, how unfun would it be to be in the meeting where you explain to Donald Trump that he's failing and his numbers suck?
Lit up tonight in blue for the workers of the MTA who keep the buses and rails moving through the mostly stay-at-home city of New York. Well, good evening once again.
Yeah, to be fair, the opening, it's a very mundane clip, but it just goes to show how upset he gets.
Day 1196 of this Trump administration, 188 days now until our presidential election. And on this day, spoken out loud to reporters in the White House, the president said this, and we quote, "This is going away. I think we're going to come up with vaccines and all, but this is going away. It's going to go. It's going to leave. It's going to be gone. It's going to be eradicated." Indeed, the president's son-in-law, as you'll see here in just a moment today, called what we are living through a great success story. For that, today, his proud father-in-law called him a genius. Trump's effort to contain the growing toll on our nation comes as he also attempts to secure a second term in office. Tonight, the Washington Post has new reporting on the challenges for the president and on the impact of weeks of marathon briefings on the polls. The paper says recent internal polling shows him slipping behind Joe Biden in some key swing states and that he erupted during a call with his 2020 campaign manager after hearing that news. Quote, "At one point in that call, Trump said he might sue Brad Parscale. Trump told Parscale he did not believe the polling that had been presented to him, even though it came from the campaign and the RNC. NBC News now has confirmed Trump's blow up. The AP has new details on this story as well. We will.
Threatening to sue Parcells.
Oh, sue Parcells. Dude, he should sue Parcells. Donald Trump, I mean, he's a TV guy. There's no way he's watching this, but I would just like to register that out into the Trump universe. It does sound like bullshit, and he should sue that guy. That's what it sounds like to me. I mean, you're paying somebody who, first of all, I don't know who this guy Parcell is. I don't know where he comes from. I know he did some social media for Trump in 2016, or at least PACs related to Trump. And look, maybe he's a talented guy. Maybe he's who Trump deserves as campaign manager. Or maybe he's a know-nothing loser who's profiting off of Donald Trump's name and now giving him bad poll advice. I don't know, yeah. But I'd certainly look into it and try to figure out what the hell is going on.
It's like that scene in Spaceballs where he's like, "I'm surrounded by assholes." Like, are you an idiot? Wait, are you absolutely an incompetent moron? I'm surrounded by incompetence.
Surrounded by total incompetence.
I mean, actually, the problem is they're competent and telling him what he doesn't want to hear. So.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like, it's just like, hey, look, I mean, we can. It's one thing to agree that a pandemic isn't going to hit the United States. But at a certain point, we got to tell him that he's about to F up Michigan. And of course, anytime Donald Trump throws a tantrum and it's reported on, then there is the response to the reporting, I'm not having a tantrum. Here is Donald Trump on Twitter. Lion Brian Williams of MSDNC. There's always grains of truth. There's always grains of truth in what Trump says.
I mean, he's got three truths in that.
Okay, yeah, actually, this is starting with three objective truths. Lion Brian Williams of MSDNC.
There's two.
A Comcast, boom, that's a big truth. Comcast scam company. I'm sure anybody that's used that particular outfit would agree and know exactly what Trump's talking about. Wouldn't know the truth if it was nailed on his wooden forehead. Remember? When he lied about his bravery in the helicopter? Totally made up story. He's a true dummy who was thrown off of network news like a dog.
Like a dog. Yep. If you want a fun Trump search on Twitter, search it for all of real Donald Trump's tweets that say like a dog, because it's some pretty good stuff there.
Jesus. Yeah, if he puts in a like a dog, he means it.
His dad must have said that. There must have been some like weird formative experience with his ultra weird, bizarre father who said that. That has to be deep in the Trump psyche somehow.
Yeah, I like Donald Trump like calling other people liars too. You lied once. Do you remember that time you were busted lying? Never happened to me.
But he's like, again, it's that difference of all these people lie, but they have some, like, I don't even know the extent that matters. I actually think it's very politically effective for Trump that because he is so uniquely mentally and emotionally damaged that he doesn't perceive his lies as lies. I think that helps him as a communicator.
Right.
Paradoxically, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, people are very used to, like, a modern set of liars and people who, you know, they spin and they talk around things.
Yeah.
And then Trump just came along and was just like, I didn't do that. Like, do you remember that clip? I can never get over that clip of the Libya one where he was on, I think, I don't know, one of the Sunday morning network shows. And it was one of the time where they first started to take him seriously and that he was railing about Libya, which, you know, again, was a horrifying disaster. And then they play this clip. He's sitting there. They're like, you know, you're attacking the Obama administration every day about Libya, but what about this? And then they go, you know, the idiots in the Trump Tower in 2011. And he's just like, you know, I've met Gaddafi. Right. I've dealt with him. We got to go. And it would be fantastic. And then they go back to him and he's just like, I mean, we've talked about this a million times. His response was essentially, well, in my version, everything went great. It didn't grow great. So obviously that wasn't what I was proposing.
Yeah. I feel like he'd be good at a polygraph because where people, when they're lying, they're so focused on the truth. He's just already moved on to what the lie gets him.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like circumstances precede essence. Okay. Let's take a little break.
We can't do not have really the capability to do that. So we kind of just have to bring Kurt on.
Oh, we're going to bring Kurt on. Okay. Sorry live. About that.
So, yeah, Brendan, if he's ready, I can admit him now. You know, I'll just do that. That sound good?
Yeah, he's ready.
Okay, cool. All right. I'm going to dip out.
Okay.
Yeah. We lost our smooth transition period.
We lost our smooth transition period. Let's
we'll get this. It back.
Yeah.
This is a smooth transition period. Joining us now is a journalist, writer, covering Mexican politics and the presidency of AMLO, Kurt Hackbarth. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Kurt, we're going to get into the specifics around Corona and what's happening now
sure.
with AMLO. But I want to start with a piece that you wrote also recently, but it's called They Got Filthy Rich. This is in Jacobin. They got right. filthy rich off of cocaine trafficking and killed leftists. Now AMLO must make them pay. This really is important because it gets into you know, the actual political contours of the drug war in Mexico, the U.S. role in it, the how the violence has escalated so precipitously, going back to the Calderon era. But what specifically, I mean, how is, first of all, explain that kind of big picture, and then how it relates to the political targeting of AMLO a little over a year into his presidency.
Yeah, so we got to go back a little bit in history. In 2006, there was a very contested presidential election with Felipe Calderon and AMLO running his first race. The official results showed Calderon winning by a fraction, a half of a percentage point, and AMLO claimed there was fraud with good reason. So Calderon, when he took office, in a sense to kind of cement himself in power, launched this drug war in December of 2006, in large part along the Colombian model. Right? And this has lasted through the Calderon administration and through the Peña Nieto administration, and has caused the deaths of some over 200,000 Mexicans. Caught up in this drug war in some way or another. AMLO, in his third run in 2018, ran on the promise of ending this, finally, this 12-year reign of bloodshed. A lot of it with U.S. weapons, it has to be pointed out. 70% of the weapons used in the Mexican drug war flow across the border from the United States freely. And AMLO has struggled with this in his first year because, as we're now discovering, and it was suspected at the time, the Calderon administration was infiltrated at its highest levels. Right now, Calderon's former security chief, who I talked about in that article, Genaro García Luna, is awaiting trial in New York City on charges of having colluded with the Sinaloa cartel. So we're at the prospect of cabinet members in the Calderon administration having been in collusion with the Sinaloa cartel the whole time that they were trying to sell this idea of a drug war to the Mexican public and the international public. And it also became a means to suppress social movements and workers' movements and other things.
Yeah, I want you to keep elaborating on that, because that Colombia example is perfect, right? Because you have, and you know, it's the model. And also I want to at least bring in, just to mention Venezuela. I mean, you know, Colombia is still a kind of main source of trafficking in Mexico as well, in a different way in Latin America. There's very little to no evidence, and a lot of people have actually countered the administration's claims of some type of a large overarching Venezuela role in narco trafficking. And clearly it's a tool for the pre-existing effort of attempting, you know, a coup in right. Venezuela. So in Colombia, going back to the 80s and 90s, and you see elements of this in the show, like Narcos, although some of it isn't kind of teased out, but you have a U.S.-backed sort of turning of the drug war into a war. This was like on steroids in Mexico during the Calderon era. Right. Then you have the element and, you know, of different administrations, sort of like you talked about the connections potentially with the Sinaloa cartel. There's some reporting of the DEA and other agencies playing kind of similar roles, you know, similar double games like that. And so you know, and again, just to parallel it with Colombia, you did have that dynamic for several years where at the bare minimum, it's like just not contestable that Colombian and U.S. Forces were at the very least allowing the Cali cartel to do this like ultra dirty war against Pablo Escobar. Obviously, Escobar was extraordinarily dirty too, but the point being that there was at the very least informal collaboration with what would become the world's biggest drug cartel. So is that all basically getting replayed over the last several years in Mexico? And did AMLO specifically say that in addition to social justice and, you know, into social democratic reforms, that he would actually change that dynamic, both in terms of U.S. foreign policy and Mexican internal interests?
They've talked in specific terms about what's called the Colombianization of Mexico. And shortly after Calderon took power, the Mérida plan took effect with the United States and Mexico. And this was a whole plan for what's called security cooperation and all kinds of other cooperation in this. So I think the answer is clearly yes. I think something else that's not to be overlooked here is that this was at the exact same time, a period when Mexico was desperately trying to privatize its oil company, Pemex, which tried to do, and the following president, Peña Nieto, succeeded in doing at least in part. So I think another thing to look at is this connection between drug wars, in quotes, and opening up countries for exploitation of minerals and natural resources. And that we saw in Colombia, and that we're seeing again in Mexico. Now, AMLO did run very specifically on a pledge to stop the violence. That was a very clear part of his program in 2018 of bringing this to an end. Now, it's been a real challenge, and the levels of violence have continued, to be honest. He's set up what's called a National Guard, which is a militarized police force, which is a new militarized police force in an attempt to combat the corruption and the infiltration of existing forces. The problem is it continues to be under military control with all that implies with regards to potentials for violations of human rights, being beyond the reach of civilian courts and a lot of other things. When Donald Trump threatened tariffs against Mexico, AMLO then readily dispatched a lot of these troops from the National Guard down to the border of Colombia, and it's now being used more to try to stop the flow of immigrants.
Right. So in this last year, just how is, you know, roughly speaking, I think, you know, it's a challenge, but there has been some real achievements. And also, I think even just like in the kind of U.S. mainstream press, mm-hmm. we see some of the same sorts of, you know, writings that you see about Evo before the coup there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's the sort of domestic elite related to the kind of international financial system. So, I mean, basically, big picture, before Corona, we'll get to Corona in a minute. Sure. How has AMLO done, relatively speaking, and then how has the backlash been?
In terms of the violence?
Just in terms of, concern with, like basically people trying, people inside Mexico being interested in dislodging him, resistance from U.S. Policymakers. How has he done what are the reviews in so far, basically?
He's done, I think, pretty well.
Yeah.
He's done pretty well over his first year and just about a half. And, you know, as you mentioned, with a lot against him. You know, the famous quote is Mexico, so far from God, so close to the United States, right?
Yeah.
That, a classic old quote. He has instituted a series of social programs in order to try to mitigate the violence. And that includes scholarships for young people to stay in school. That includes the country's first ever national pension program, a disability pension. He's working towards a form of national health insurance. That on the social side. He also has a series of big ticket infrastructure projects, which have been more controversial. It's the Maya train in the Yucatan Peninsula, which would be a tourist train connecting up the tourist sites of the Yucatan, which has been heavily criticized, rightly, I think, by indigenous groups. He wants to build a new refinery on the Atlantic coast in order to make Mexico energy sufficient and not depend on American refineries to refine America's oil. And with regards to, I think, the most important thing, he's really attacked the Mexican culture of corruption that had grown up over the last two administrations. And that has been huge. It was really underreported in the American press how corrupt, for example, the Peña Nieto administration was.
Right.
If Peña Nieto had been the president of Venezuela, it would have been front page news every day. But we're talking about certainly the most corrupt administration in Latin America. Right now, Peña Nieto's former head of the oil company Pemex, Emilio Lozoya, is in jail in Spain awaiting extradition to Mexico on charges of illegal financing of his 2012 presidential campaign. Peña Nieto's head of social development, Rosario Robles, is in jail here on charges of funneling hundreds of millions of dollars through public entities into private corporations. There's no end to what we could talk about with regards to the corruption in previous administrations. And AMLO has been attacking that on several fronts.
What about the charges that are sort of lazily thrown around, at least in my view, that he's autocratic? Now, again, it's not that the guy is above reproach or there aren't legitimate right. questions or right. critiques that emerge from indigenous communities or social movements or anybody, if it's legitimate. Sure. But, guy's democratically elected. He has high approval ratings. I mean, where does the notion of him being autocratic come from? And is there any validity to it or none?
I think it's lazy reporting. AMLO is a progressive populist. And there's this idea from the kind of neoliberal press that anybody who's a populist is an autocrat.
Right.
Distinguishing between right-wing populism and left populism. Let's just look where we came from. You know, in the Calderón administration, García Luna, who we mentioned, was openly threatening journalists, actually sending out death threats to journalists who were investigating him.
Yep.
In the Peña Nieto administration, Carmen Aristegui, who was one of Mexico's most popular journalists, reported on a corruption scandal involving Peña Nieto's wife, who had a huge luxury house built for her by a favored contractor, and she was thrown off the radio. She had a popular radio program that was ended. So to call AMLO an autocrat in the light of the administrations that came before him is laughable.
Right.
The freedom of the press in Mexico in the AMLO administration has been more than it's been for generations. Now, AMLO criticizes the press, and I think they're not above, you know, as we've seen in their so-called reporting of the COVID pandemic, they're not above criticism. But I think that's where some of the, you know, they see AMLO criticizing the press in his morning press conference, and they say, aha, there's an autocrat who's, you know, trying to take down the press the way Trump does. And it's really a very, very, very lazy comparison.
Well, we saw that here. I mean, this ludicrous notion of comparing Bernie Sanders' criticism right. of corporate monopolies. Like, you know, maybe Jeff Bezos has a self-interest in not covering the inequality crisis.
Exactly.
Or maybe there's an incentive structure. Oh, well, that's absolutely the same thing as, you know, Donald Trump, like, you know, talking shit about the New York Times or whining about Acosta or whatever. So it's, it sounds like very much a similar dynamic with maybe even more dangerous potential implications. So I want to get overall how AMLO has covered Corona as his policy on COVID and then how the press has covered it. But I want to just start with a comparison. And it seems to me that as far as I understand, AMLO has maybe rolled things out like shutdowns more slowly, but he has not adopted a Swedish approach of we're actually going to do something really different. We're going to experiment essentially with not having a lockdown. And I think people are very interested in whether Sweden could be successful or not because none of us want to be in a long-term lockdown. Now, the numbers seem to be very clear that Sweden has not been successful. And obviously they're taking this risk and it's not working out and they have, you know, some of the best healthcare and social infrastructure in the world. So, you know, it's less dangerous for them to experiment with this than America or Mexico for that matter. But that being said, if AMLO rolling things out more slowly, which is sort of my understanding of what he's done, and correct me if I'm wrong, is a global catastrophe and another sign of his anti-scientific, autocratic, whatever. But then Sweden actually has a very clear policy, basically contradicting the global consensus, That's interesting and innovative policy from, you know, one of the smartest countries in the world. Can we just start, go anywhere you want, but I just think that contrast is very illustrative with press bias and assumptions.
I absolutely agree. And it speaks volumes to the bias towards European and so-called first world countries in this. That Sweden, if Mexico were to do something remotely like what Sweden did, could you imagine, you know, how they'd be, you know, pilloried by, you know, national and international press interests that would just use that as a club to beat AMLO's progressive experiment. And we saw this in this recent Financial Times editorial that I mentioned in my recent piece. You know, the Financial Times, from the country of Boris Johnson and herd mentality, is there on its podium lecturing Mexico on its coronavirus response? I mean, please. With regards to AMLO's response, I think it's been, in the whole, fairly good. The virus was a little bit slower to get here. It was a little bit slower than the U.S. and certainly Italy, Spain, Western Europe. And Mexico was actually relatively ahead of the curve in closing main things. It was ahead of the curve, certainly compared to Italy and Spain and others, in closing schools, in closing non-essential federal government functions. Where AMLO was a little bit slow was in his own holding rallies. He was still out there with the people, somewhat beyond what would have been recommendable. And we can discuss why that was too. But in the main, the closings happened ahead of time.
So then how is this? I mean, if you want to, you can explain why he's still out, you know, why he was out rallying later, but also, you know, more broadly, give us some real examples. There's a Financial Times editorial. There's some incredible examples from the Mexican press.
Yeah.
You know, how relative to what's happened, get into the details of how this has been misreported.
Well, this has everything to do with the structure of the Mexican press, which is, you know, an oligarchic press system with two main television stations, Televisa and TV Azteca, and a series of, you know, newspapers owned by wealthy people with their own interests. So, sound familiar, right? during previous administrations, the press was semi-controlled through massive spending and government publicity. The government would spend millions of pesos in government publicity, you know, to put advertisements and such in newspapers and to commercials on television stations. But it became a way to funnel millions and millions and millions of pesos of government publicity into the coffers of the television stations and the newspapers. That was called the chayote in Mexican Spanish. That kept the press on side. They were, you know, indirectly bought off the mainstream press. And then even a lot of these pundits and anchors would have their own like private press companies or websites, which would also get more government publicity and even more, you know, enrich their coffers. AMLO comes into power and he drastically cuts the budget for government publicity. Mm-hmm. They're not getting the subsidy they used to get. That's one thing. And the second thing is, you know, it's a pundit class of conservative, wealthy, you know, columnists and TV presenters who are in absolute no contact with, you know, with the Mexican public and cannot understand why AMLO continues to be popular, you know, with 60 and 70% approval ratings, you know, in the face of what to them is clearly a disaster. And their own Mexico City bubble. It's just an absolute disaster, and how can people not see it the way they do? Now, it's one thing for them to have their opinions, but it's another for them to then take the next step and report fake news. And they've been doing throughout this COVID crisis, and I mentioned a few examples in the piece. You had kind of the former premier anchor in Mexican television tweeting out the news that this Jose Curi had died. This magnate. You have people tweeting out news that Mexico is about to enter into a phase three tomorrow, severe level three pandemic response. You have people tweeting out even stuff I didn't mention in the article, that the government was buying pirated medicines, that private labs were not being allowed to do testing. The list goes on and on and on, and you have these high-paid pundits with no scruples whatsoever participating to the point of ridiculousness in this fake news barrage that's been going on.
And you also, let's talk about, can you talk substantively about the social bailout? Because that is, I mean, certainly the most important thing from a human well-being perspective outside of the pandemic itself. Sure. Talk about what AMLO's actually done, and then talk about the irony of the Financial Times. Now, I will say, Financial Times definitely is on the sort of side of the financial press of, hey, let's give the peasants a little bit. Like, we don't want to completely have social disruption. So I will say that, you know, Martin Wolf for a decade during after the recession was writing and talking about the need to deal with some income inequality. And then, you know, of course, they sat down and destroyed Corbyn when that actually became something viable on the table in the UK, a real thing. So that being said, the incredible irony of the Financial Times attacking a progressive populist in a developing country for not having a big enough social bailout.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say about that? You know, and you've got Moody's and Fitch and Standard and Poor's lowering Mexico's bond rating, you know, taking advantage of COVID to slap down Mexico's bond rating for its sovereign debt and for Pemex, its oil company's debt, which makes it more expensive to borrow. And then on the other hand, they're saying, why isn't he borrowing more? Why isn't he doing stimulus? You know? And if he were to do that, then they'd be criticizing him for being a classic overspending Latin American, you know, leftist throwing money at problems. So you really can't keep up with how they're criticizing him on this. And I think there's another point to make that's important. Mexico has a revolving line of credit with the IMF, which AMLO has not wanted to use, I think for very legitimate reasons. Once you start getting in debt with the IMF then starts dictating to you the, what they want you to do to, in order to pay them back. And usually that means raising taxes on the poor, such as gasoline taxes or sales taxes, which in Mexico is the value-added tax. It's happening now in El Salvador, which got an IMF loan, and the IMF is right there saying, all right, you guys have got to start doing this, this, and this for fiscal year 2022. That said, I think AMLO could be doing more. He's been very macroeconomically, he's been very macroeconomically orthodox.
Yep.
But I think we have to understand that Mexico's not in a position like the United States. It's not the same case. You know, if Mexico deviates, its currency is at risk. You know, investors flee the country. Oil prices have tanked. He's got to be careful with what he does.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I think sometimes that's not taken sufficiently into account, his room for maneuver. One thing I would criticize AMLO on is that he's refused to raise taxes on the wealthy, which is what needs to happen.
Right.
Or later. Mexico's wealthy get away with murder. They pay very little taxes. There's all kinds of loopholes in the tax code. The capital gains on stocks is 10%, which is a joke. You know, Mexico is a factory of millions of poor and a handful of some of the richest people in the world.
Why has he not wanted to do that? What is his calculus in terms of his, and maybe, you know what, can we just talk about the, I think the two kind of clear areas where there's sort of like, okay, there's areas that AMLO deserves a lot more credit than he's getting. And you can see all of the institutional and international bias against him because he is even, you know, even a, I mean, look, you know, I've covered Brazil a lot. I mean, Lula was an extraordinarily conciliatory strategic leader. He still becomes a victim of a U.S. foreign policy process, right? So I, you know, there is the idea of anybody in Latin America with an even modest social democratic agenda is going to get run afoul of U.S. press and other aspects of U.S. foreign policy apparatus. Then there's, okay, maybe we genuinely, you know, have a disagreement want to kind of focus on different perspectives on something like, you know, a development project that implicates different types of ecology or First Nations people or whatever. That's important. That's a worthy debate. And then where are the areas where, you know, we would like to see him raise taxes on the wealthy. We'd like to see him really be a counterforce to the Trump administration's just vicious, barbarous treatment of migrants and asylum seekers. But in terms of his actual political capital, both domestically and internationally, in addition to everything else he's taken on, what is the real room he has? And I guess specifically on those two issues, to first raise taxes on the wealthy, and secondly, try to counter the Trump administration on migration. Because it just seems to me, from what I followed, and obviously, you know, infinitely mm-hmm. more than me, those are the areas where it's like, okay, the criticism makes sense, of course. But, you know, okay, you know, the guy isn't a superhero. What's the context for him to be able to make those moves? Yeah.
I think that's a great question. With regards to the tax issue, he ran in 2018, his third campaign, on a no new tax pledge. So he dug himself in a hole right there. And has tried to keep national elites on side. He's announced an infrastructure project, which includes the building of 100 new universities, roads, bridges, a whole national infrastructure program besides a new airport in Mexico City, the refinery we mentioned, and using those contracts to benefit the national elite instead of the international elite, kind of along the lines of a Lula.
Yeah.
Which seems to, you know, satisfy, you know, Mexico's voracious corporate class, but then you saw with COVID that they're willing to turn on a dime, you know, when it's convenient to them, which is always the problem when you try to stroke the backs of a corporate elite, through contracts and such. With regards to countering the U.S., I think there's also room for criticism for AMLO on that. He's been very conciliatory with Trump to a fault. He succeeded in having the tariff threat wiped out, at least for now. But that's also come at the price of his using the National Guard to crack down on migrants, a lot of them coming through Central American countries that, as we know, have been destabilized historically by the U.S., you know, right. which is a whole other story.
And today, too. I mean, just to be clear.
And it's happening.
Right.
And he's even allowed asylum seekers in the U.S. to be temporarily housed in Mexico while waiting their asylum cases. Mexico has refused to become what's called a safe third nation, like Canada, which would require asylum seekers to seek asylum in Mexico before they could seek asylum in the U.S. He's refused that, to his credit. But he's been overly conciliatory. What's his room for maneuver with the United States? I think there's somewhat more than he's used in both cases. And I say that hopefully with an understanding of what's against him, but I think there's somewhat more, he has somewhat more leeway than he's used. He's got a 70% approval rating. He's got majorities in both houses of Congress. There's a lot of people who have been involved in social movements for decades, and all of those flowed into the election of 2018, where they finally overcame a system of fraud and a system of many other obstacles. So I think there is more room for maneuver than he's done. And I try to say that without being judgmental, because I know what he's up against.
Yeah, I mean, and not least of which, the threats from the North, which, I mean, right. You know, it just strikes me that if you already see the press drumbeat against him, and it really does echo, you know, I think of Evo a lot, because it is the most recent coup. And then, you know, drawing parallels with other leaders who, you know, again, I think Lula is the best president of the 21st century. So I have no undercutting of him. I think he did incredible things for the Brazilian people and he's a great statesman. But, you know, again, was not somebody who was understood his role as a president. And that means obviously you have to work with everybody and, you know, you're not a commentator. It's a different job. But, you know, so he still ran afoul of U.S. foreign policy, I think specifically just with, you know, not privatizing strategic resources in Brazil. And so, you know, as we follow this, it just seems to me with AMLO that we got to be so careful. I mean, you know, way more than me, and I'm sure you're right in terms of his approval rating, but man, that room for maneuver can turn back and hit you in the face really quickly.
It can. Yeah. And let's remember that, you know, one of the first foreign policy challenges AMLO had to face when taking office was refusing to recognize Juan Guaido as president of Venezuela.
Right.
He stuck his neck right out on that, barely months into office, and said recognizing a U.S. puppet. He didn't say U.S. puppet, but he said, you know, we're not recognizing Guaido, and even went down to the Organization of American States, and Mexico was practically alone in this. Then in the Bolivian coup, AMLO sent a plane to get Evo the hell out of there.
Yeah.
To Mexico and potentially saved his life.
Yes.
The time when he was being hunted down.
Yep.
So, you know, Mexico under AMLO is regaining a degree of its leadership role in Latin America. A generation of neoliberal, very subservient governments to the U.S. had frittered away. And both of them were expenses of political capital.
Absolutely. So what should we keep in mind as we follow AMLO and get a kind of proper sense of his performance out of COVID and everything else, that it isn't this big disaster that's being spun in most of the press?
No, it's not. No, it's not. The right was hoping that with its fake news barrage and its all-out offensive, it could use the COVID pandemic as a means to weaken AMLO ahead of the congressional elections coming up next year, or in the best of cases, dislodge him from power. And the Financial Times even said, well, they should start taking legal action against AMLO's measures. I mean, what the hell is the Financial Times, you know,
what?
Saying shit like that? You know?
All right.
And the right has failed to do that. The right-wing parties are in absolute disarray. Felipe Calderon basically ruined the PAN, the party he was elected on, and is actually trying to start a new party. Enrique Peña Nieto basically ruined the PRI, the party he was elected on. So it's interesting to see that a lot of the opposition to AMLO is coming outside of the sphere of parties, because right. And the PRI are so discredited because of their recent administrations. So you see that both their business groups, their, you know, bots paid for by Calderon, there are a whole shadowy series of dark money paying a lot of internet campaigns and kind of chamber of commerce kind of crusades against AMLO. The reality is that cases of COVID in Mexico have not been exaggerated. The health system has not broken down. It's not been like Quito where you saw people, you know, bodies out in the streets.
Right.
That has not happened despite, you know, hysterical predictions that was just about to happen. Now the curve is going up in Mexico now. These will be the critical 2 weeks in seeing where this goes.
Right. But,
you know, the next 2 weeks will tell, but AMLO has worked out a deal where private hospitals participating private hospitals have to use 50% of their available beds to treat COVID patients. You know, the public system, you know, which has been devastated by years of neoliberal governments, is holding up. The public is, you know, mainly respecting the quarantine. It's not an obligatory lockdown, but it's, you know, a government, you know, with a lot of government pushing a quarantine, and that's going to stay on through the mid-May in some places and through the end of May. And so the large predicted disaster has not occurred. That the press has been whipping up, and Amo's opponents are furious because they were happy to have people die if that meant that they could bludgeon the government with that.
Right. Oh, Kurt Hackbarth, really appreciate it. Everybody read Kurt's reporting on AMLO and contemporary Mexican politics and U.S. foreign policy and Jacobin. I believe you're working on a book about the 2018 election, right?
Yeah, we're actually working on a project with Verso on AMLO's first 2 years. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
Very important leader and place to follow right now. And in some ways, an area of hope in very bleak international politics at the moment. Kurt Hackbarth, stay safe. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. Matt and Brandon, you guys there?
Yep.
Hey, so we're still doing the break before the fun half, correct?
Yeah, I'm going to play MR Fun, but we'll bring Jamie in here for plugs and we can do that fun stuff.
Okay. Well, let me just start by saying become a member of the Majority Report, majority.fm/become a member. Also, subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't yet. I will say, I think actually the first orders are... I know at least that people are telling me that orders in my book are sold out, which is awesome.
Ooh.
Which I'm loving, but I would still go try to get
thank
a copy.
Thank you, George Soros.
Thank you very much, George Soros. George Soros summoned me to his death chamber where he was taking blood from a young blood donor. And he said, please, more Dave Rubin material.
Yeah.
Actually, there isn't very much Dave Rubin material. It's particularly, I would say, the conclusion of the book on the African National Congress and cosmopolitan socialism. That there is a bigger project and argument there, which I'm really excited about. So check it out, Against the Web, Cosmopolitan Answer to New Right. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks show, we had on Yolian Agbu, and she is an organizer with the May 1st strikes that are happening tomorrow, and some really great coordination between students and labor organizing with that. We're going to talk more about that in the fun half. That's a very important effort to support. And we also had a really fun time with Judah Friedlander. Tonight, we're going to do a stream on Teamster organizing at 5 o'clock. It's going to be available for everybody, and the union moment in COVID. And then on next Tuesday, we're having Torre Reed. It was an amazing book called Towards Freedom. And Doris Apollo of Telesor to talk about U.S. foreign policy in the Caribbean during Corona. Patreon.com/TMBS is how you get the whole thing. And check out, I'm still very stoked about the Cornel West interview. So, and of course, subscribe to the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube and check out TMBS.fm and whole bunch of new, we can't do live shows obviously right now, which really sucks. I super miss them. Can't wait till we can do them again, but we're working on a series of TMBS guides. So that's going to be some new projects. So lots cooking in TMBS land. Matt, what's going on at Literary Hangover?
What's going on now is everyone that has a Twitch account is subscribing to twitch.tv/literary hangover. Basically what I've been doing is doing these study halls where I'll play a video game like A Plague's Tale: Innocence while I listen to Michel Foucault talk about plague towns and the surveillance state and things like that. And actually tonight I think I'm going to be playing Half-Life 2 while listening to 1984, very appropriate matchup to anybody familiar with both of those. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to grow right now. Just zoomed past 600 followers, so twitch.tv/literary hangover. Subscribe now, folks.
That is awesome. Jamie, you're here.
I am.
You're also quiet, but you do have a mic quiet. Stand this time.
Can you
Hello?
Hear me?
Hold on.
Can you hear me?
We can, but your mic is a little bit low.
It's low?
How about there we go.
That's better.
There you go.
That's better.
Better?
Yep.
Yeah, go.
Excellent, excellent. So this week on the Antifada, I know I said we were doing a Bernie postmortem, but that was postponed. Yesterday, we ran an episode about the U.S. and China and their political economy and how they became intertwined. It is the first of a two-part series on China. So if you're interested in China and what's going on over there, check it out. This weekend, we're recording an episode with Assad Haider on depoliticization. That will serve as our Bernie postmortem. I think it's going to be pretty good. And also, I got the date wrong last time. I'm going to put a link to it in the episode description. But Andy and I will be appearing at the virtual version of Red May Seattle on May 7th, talking about coronavirus and the future of work with three very smart people whose names I don't want to screw up. There they are. Magali Miranda, Aaron Bananov, and Annie McClanahan. So I will be sure to put a link for anyone who wants to check it out.
Sweet. All right. I guess, guys, we are going to take, we're going to take the MR Fun Half song break.
Yep.
Matt, is that correct?
Correct.
Here All right. Are. And we will see you on the Fun Half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.